Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark, and I'm back again, yet again and again, with another phenomenal episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into our amazing pod of the week, I just wanted to remind everybody that if you haven't done so already, go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl, and please go to the podcast section. You can see other podcasts, but you can also see something called iTunes, where you can go give this show a ratings and review. It so helps out having all these amazing, incredible people doing incredible and awesome things to inspire us all. I need to be inspired as well. And each one of these people that I have on always do that for me. Also, there's a tab called Amelia's Everest. I continue to raise money for the National Epilepsy Foundation. If you haven't heard from my podcast in the past, my daughter Amelia has epilepsy, and so we're trying to create more money and awareness so one day she and others like her can be healed. Okay, so on that note, let's jump into the pod. This week, I've got an amazing rock star. There's not many people that I have on the pod that have 4 degrees. She's an expert in neurobiology. She's brilliant. She's incredible. She's got a phenomenal background, which we're going to get into. I think more or less she's Superwoman. Her name is Christine Willemeyer. Christine, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thank you so much for the lovely intro.
Well, that's a big intro, so you better live up to it, which I know you do, because obviously you've had this history of coming through, and you're somebody of amazing accomplishment, and I think there's a real tie on a couple different levels, which we can get into. There's a tie because of the science that you've studied over the years, really dealing with the brain, number one. Number two is, as a former NFL player, the CTE issues that we have amongst the brotherhood is so strong. And there's been, I think, leaps and bounds of progress that have been made over the year. And I want to talk to you about your work with other NFL players. And then number three, epilepsy is a brain dysfunction. It's a disease that I've been dealing now with my daughter since she was 8. She's 21 years old now. And just the tie-in with that, I've got buddies too with Parkinson's. And so this is such an important area that you go. But I think, you know, I was really sitting back and digesting your story last night. And each one of these kind of has a tie. And it really, like so many times in all of our lives, it gets back to kind of where you were growing up, some influences you had in your life. And you have a background that I haven't run across actually ever, which it was really cool. And as one athlete to another, I wanted you to talk more about your competitive show jumping. Like, how do you even get into that? And the falls and the accidents that you've had, because when you're jumping over these 4 or 5 foot bars, fences, whatever you call them, I know there's times when you've fallen off and picking yourself back up, getting back on that horse and, you know, brushing yourself off and going from there. So first of all, how did you get into this?
Whew, you unpacked a lot there. And Mark, I just want to say thank you again for inviting me to be a guest on your podcast. Really, it's truly an honor. And so I started riding at the age of 7. And like most parents do with their kids, you know, I was doing gymnastics, I was doing ballet, I was taking classes at the Art Institute. You know, you kind of have your kids trying out different things to figure out what are they going to excel at. And I happened to go to a riding camp, a Kelly's riding camp, and fell in love with riding horses. And I happened to grow up in a suburb outside of Chicago called Barrington, which is essentially horse country. So a lot of my neighbors had horses. So it just started from going to Kelly's camp to, you know, all of a sudden I'm now at a barn called Arde Farm, which was in Elgin, Illinois, at the age of 7. And I have my first quarter horse named Strawberry. And I think I was just very lucky because the barn that I happen to be showing at, my trainer, who is Alex Jane, happened to be somebody who had wanted to go to the Olympics. And I just had the good fortune of having the coaching and training of somebody who, well, he hadn't made the Olympics. He had that drive and that desire to coach and coach every single person who was in that barn to the level where they could be potentially be an Olympic show jumper. So the origins were just very sort of very natural, right? It's I started in it because it's the area that I grew up in, and you know, started riding at the barn, and riding for me was something that I did every day, just the way you did playing football. You know, every day after school, I would be at the barn. Every weekend, there was a horse show. Started out very naturally doing what we call the hunters. And for people who aren't very familiar with the riding industry, so we have hunters and we have jumpers. So hunter competitions are really judged on the horse and how well you take the horses around the courses. And jumpers is more about not the actual judging of the horse and the rider, but it's just how quickly you can get over a course of 10 to 12 to 14 fences. You know, you need to jump them clean and you need to jump them for speed. So it sort of took the nature of being judged for the horse. And now the competition is just about you and the clock. So that's really how it started.
That's incredible. So now, so you start at a younger age and you go all the way through high school and you're spending every single weekend, you're doing all this kind of stuff. In the world, I know you said like the ultimate is to go to the Olympics. Did you have that in your sights as something that you wanted to do?
Absolutely. So I essentially rode for a decade, age 7 all the way to 17. And throughout that time, our family owned 5 different horses. And the kind of training, so I was training with people who ended up being Olympic show jumpers. Chris Kapler, who went to the Los Angeles Olympics, was a gold and silver medalist. So he was training at the barn with us. And my trainer son is currently on the US Olympic team. So I was trained with all of these incredible people. And, you know, like every young, you know, wide-eyed child, you know, you aspire to be able to reach that kind of level of success. And thankfully, I think I was lucky. So I really went into the show jumpers, which is jumping the big fences for speed. You know, the fences can get as big as 5 feet high. You know, they're very wide and you're essentially just jumping them at these crazy angles as fast as possible. So I was just a little bit of a maverick. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that I got from being a competitive equestrian. And when you're doing it during that time in development, when you just learn to have no fear. So I think there was this wonderful thing that I learned from being an athlete, training at that level and showing at horse shows all over the United States, where every day you're at the barn, you're determined, you know, you're jumping fences, you're winning classes. And the reason why this is important now is I really have an appreciation of the importance of sports and how sports can really shape your later career, right? And your dreams and your aspirations and give you the will and determination to succeed no matter what. And, you know, taking it full circle with, you know, athletics and the NFL, you know, one of the things that I encountered through riding and showing horses is I fell off many, many times. You know, in a 10-year period of showing, I didn't fall off one time, two times, 10 times. I've probably fallen off hundreds of times. And I don't want to sort of jump to what we're going to talk about a little bit later, but I think that, you know, is very important when we think about sports today and collision-based sports and, you know, should you have your kids play sports? And here I am, you know, as a scientist who studies this for a living, having grown up showing competitive sports and, you know, having taken a fair number of hits and falls and, you know, life-threatening injuries.
Before we get to the life-threatening injuries of falling off a horse, which I can't imagine, what does it take to be a great, I mean, is it the horse or is it the jockey? Jockey is probably the wrong word, the rider.
Yeah, jockey's the wrong word for this, for competitive show jumping. So to be a great equestrian, they say that you have to have a great eye. And what that means is when you're jumping a horse over a fence, you need to be able to get the horse to the right distance so it clears the fence easily. And, you know, when you're jumping small fences, that's really easy. But when you're jumping fences that are 3'9", 4'3", you know, and you're racing at them very quickly and taking them at really unusual angles, because in jump offs, it's all about you and the clock. You need to get around a short course as quickly as possible without dropping a rail on a fence. So to be a great rider, you have to have a great eye, meaning you can get a horse over a fence. If you get them to the wrong distance, what happens is they either, it's called a chip, where they kind of get to the base and have to really pop over the fence, or you'll take one too long. And if they take one too long, they can end up landing in the fence or pulling a rail. And horse and rider are very sort of intuitively connected. So if a horse does not trust you, right? If you're running to a fence that's 3'9" or 4'3" and you get him to a bad distance and he doesn't trust you because your eye isn't developed, he's going to stop. And you know what? You're going to land in the fence, right? He's going to stop and you're going to go flying off or you're going to land in a fence. And trust me, it's not fun to fall. You know, I know as an NFL player, I'm sure it's not fun to get hit when you're not expecting it.
No,
you know, taking a fall when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, it's funny. It's not scary to fall off. That's the one thing that I learned probably from my trainer, because when you fall off, he just yell at you to get back on the horse and get over the fence.
What were your fears?
You know, what's funny. My only fear, I remember. So again, the barn was in Elgin. It was called Arde Farm. And I remember when my mom would take me and we'd turn the corner, right, to go into the stables. And I'd see my trainer, Alex, sitting on one of the fences in the ring. And I knew, I was like, okay, I'm getting a lesson today. So I was kind of, I knew Alex sitting on the fence means we're getting a lesson. And with Alex, the lessons were really challenging. So for people who ride horses, you know, you've got your saddle, you've got your equipment, you're holding onto your reins, right? You have all these things that you can hold on to. Well, what Alex did to make us all great riders is he would say, okay, Kristen, for this lesson, I'm going to have you tie your reins in a knot and I'm going to have you jump a course of fences and I want you to have your arms out like this. So when I turn the corner, he's like, I want you to let go of the reins. You're not going to be holding the reins. You're going to be approaching the fence. You're not holding onto the reins at all. And you're going to make this horse jump over, whether it's a 3-foot fence or 3'6" in fence. So not only did I have to be confident, I actually had to have great balance, right? And so I was more fearful of Alex and the kind of creative lessons that he would come up with. But the beauty of the way he trained us, right? Tying our reins in a knot or jump, he'd even have us jump fences with our eyes closed. So if I'd come around the corner and approach a fence, say 5 or 6 strides out, he'd say, okay, I want you to close your eyes, right? And when you get into jump seat, which is when you're going over the fence, I want you to be like climbing a rope. And I mean, I remember at the time thinking, this is crazy, but I was excited, you know, kind of like an adrenaline junkie. You're like, okay, this is really scary. And he's pushing me past. It's one thing to be afraid of jumping a big fence. And then it's another thing to be afraid of jumping one and not being able to hold onto the reins. Right. And to put things in perspective, at that age, I'm all of 100 pounds and I'm riding a horse that's anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 pounds. I mean, these are very large animals. And I have a true appreciation of why Alex has now created so many, you know, Olympians, because of the type of training that we received. And while I may not have gone to the Olympics, you know, I did competitive show jumping at a very elite level, and he pushed me, and he pushed me to the point where you had no fear, so that when you went into the show ring and you were competing with, you know, anybody from around the United States, you went in and you knew you could nail that course. You knew anything that you would encounter in a show ring would never be as hard as what Alex put you through in the training ring. So, you know, I just have so much respect for him and what he's done, and the extraordinary riders that he's put out into the world.
Well, I think the bottom line is you have to be, in any sport, you have to be fearless, right? And I've seen this happen so many different times, more in the NFL than I did in college, but where somebody would go out there and they'd get popped. Like, I mean, it was horrific. And that what the psychology in the brain of being out there and being able to do and conquer whatever you think and thought you could conquer vanished. And because of that happened, they were no longer that same player. And I'm sure that just trickles across every sport that you can possibly think of. I totally appreciate about the whole idea of about really training you in a way that you have to be fearless about jumping, whether you're holding on to the reins or not. Before we kind of take a leap into what you're doing today, there must be one or two times when you went down, you suffered a concussion or something much more horrific to your body that made you second guess, you know, is this really what I want to do?
Well, I have. I mean, I've had so many injuries and accidents, but truly the one that is most memorable is happened when I was 13, and I was at a local horse show riding Razzmatazz, who was a large pony. So he's a dapple gray large pony, and I was in a children's adult jumper class. So the fences are between 3'6" and 3'9", and I was going around a corner quickly, and he slipped. So the show ring was wet. He slipped. So his back end goes down. I go flying over him. He scrambles to get up and he steps on my chest, and my ribs end up puncturing my lungs. Oh. So at the time, it's really interesting. So at the time, I had popped right back up after the accident, not even really realizing what happened. And I remember them putting me in the ambulance. And the person in the ambulance, the EMT, was saying, whatever you do, don't go to sleep, right? You're 13. You're like, yeah, I'm good. Like, I'm not going to sleep. But all of a sudden, you just see the lights go out. And cut to, I'm in the hospital. My one lung was filling up with blood. You know, it's actually a condition that was called hemopneumothorax. So the interesting thing about that accident is, I went back to riding. You know, I had problems breathing for the next several years because it caused a scar tissue to accumulate in my lungs, but everything healed up nicely. And, you know, I'm shocked because I do have friends who have ridden. I know people have gotten paralyzed from riding accidents. We've all heard of Christopher Reeve. I mean, it happens, right? I was participating in a sport where falls can be life-threatening. And I, you know, to this day, I look back and I'm thankful, you know, that he stepped on my chest and didn't step on my face or didn't crush something else and you know, cause more permanent injury. But I'll tell you, I went right back to riding. I didn't skip a beat. And I think that goes to show sometimes when we're young and fearless. I don't know. I think riding helped develop that quality of fearlessness. And, you know, I thank my trainer, Alex, because I think he really instilled that into me. I mean, he was a really tough coach. So whenever anything happened in a show ring or the riding ring, you just knew you fell off, you got right back up, right? There was no crying. There was no running over to your mom at the side of the ring. It was like, you get up, you get back on the horse and you get him over the fence, right? It was always like a training moment to get back up. And I think that's been applicable in life.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that sports all teach us great lessons in life. For you, it definitely taught you discipline. And it must have. I'm making that leap because you wouldn't be as nearly accomplished as you are today. So I want to make that bridge now. Mm-hmm. So now it's time for you to go off to college at 17. You're going on 18. And now where you're going to go to college and go to Boston College. At that time, did you have in the back of your mind that you wanted to be a doctor or studying the brain? Or is that something that kind of organically grew out through your experiences at BC?
You know, I started getting more interested in the mind through sports. So when I was at Boston College, I studied psychology, but I was really interested in continuing the thread of athletics and the brain and psychology. So I thought I wanted to go into sports psychology. And, you know, at the time, which was in the, you know, early 90s, there weren't a lot of sports psychologists. You know, I joined an association for sports psychology, learned more about it. I really wanted to work with athletes and Olympic athletes, helping them improve their mental game. And it's just, I think it's because it was something that I'd done for 10 years. And since I wasn't going to go and continue show jumping, I wanted to somehow take that 10 years of experience and apply it into a career that I thought would be fun. So sort of the path went from sports psychology. And then I realized I really gravitated towards more of the hard science. And I think I also had that curiosity about going into medicine and medical school, you know, and working with patients. So when I would come home from college in the summers, I started doing rotations in the emergency room at Northwestern Medical Center and the post-anesthesia unit at Children's Memorial. And I shadowed an orthopedic surgeon. Like, I started doing what I would call my background homework. Like, if I'm going to go to medical school, which discipline do I see myself in? Where do I think I'm going to be happiest? And interestingly enough, I, you know, happened to be dating somebody at the time who was one of the team doctors for the New England Patriots. And he's the one, he actually was really pivotal in changing my decision to go from traditional MD route into the neurosciences. He just saw that I had an aptitude for science that I don't even think I recognized. And I decided to go with that recommendation. So instead of, you know, taking all of my background and really doing the med school route, I'm like, you know what? I think I want to try this science and see if I do. You know, I just wanted to see, you know, how sometimes people just inspire you and it's literally a pivot in the road. Like, your life would have gone one way and now it went in another. And
yep, I do know. Yeah, keep going.
So, you know, I decided I had a lot of respect for him. He had graduated from Harvard and, you know, sat on their admissions committee. And I thought, okay, you know, he knows something. I'm like, maybe I should take this science thing to heart. And what I ended up doing is applying to a master's program at UCLA. And I wanted to study physiological science. And I thought, okay, this is the fork in the road. I'm either going to take this physiological science degree and I'm going to explore work in a laboratory setting, which is what I did. I worked in a laboratory of neuroendocrinology, studying how hormones act in the brain. And I thought, I'm going to give this 2 years. If I don't really like this laboratory life, I can take this degree and go off to medical school, right? I can just apply and, you know, I'm sure get into, you know, a nice medical school. But, you know, it ended up being that I fell in love with the laboratory life. And I think that's partly because I'm an only child and only children do very well sort of in isolated environments. And, you know, being a neuroscientist, neurobiologist, it's on the one hand, a career that is, it's introspective. It can be isolating. You know, there's many days where I've spent 8 hours in a confocal microscope room looking at neurons under a dish, under a microscope in a dish for, like I said, 8 to 10 hours, and you're by yourself and you're trying to figure things out. And I found there was a part of my personality that really enjoyed that, enjoyed the introspective work of understanding the mechanisms of why, you know, neurons die in a degenerative disease, or just getting into the sort of minutia and the details of that work. But there was also a pull to want to work with people and patients. Like I still had that desire, you know, to want to be in medicine. And I ended up finding that perfect balance after I got my all of my degrees.
So you have, I know it goes beyond this, but when you start talking about what you have specialized in and around the brain, you're talking about CTE, you're talking about ALS, you're talking about Parkinson's disease, and there's a bunch of others in there. How do you fill that gap between these diseases exist out there today and what traditional medicine knows, you know, in our current way that we look at everything? You know, somebody has one of these issues and you give them a pill, but that's not really the thing that heals them in the long term. It's just some kind of band-aid to help them manage their life. And again, I do have experience with this. We talked about before we went live with my daughter with her epilepsy. And so we were on this constant quest to try to figure out, you know, how we can one day set her free. Right. Mm-hmm. And so as a, from a doctorate standpoint, how are you trying to fill that gap? Are you trying to figure out that missing, you know, thing that is in there that if you added a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know, it's the combination. I'm making this way too simple, but I'm just trying to understand, you know, like how do you bridge that gap?
There's so much to unpack with that question. It's a fantastic question. So part of the reason why I ended up first doing the master's degree and then continuing on to do another master's and PhD in neurobiology is I wanted to study a disease that we think is incurable. So whether that's Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and I ended up working in the field of Parkinson's, studying a gene that becomes mutated in the young onset form of Parkinson's disease called Parkin1. And at the time of my initial studies, you know, I went into it for just the pure curiosity of, you know, I want to understand more about this disease, what happens at the level of the single cell. If we understand the mechanisms of why the neurons are dying, then we can do things, right? What kind of preventative things? What kind of stem cell technologies are available? What kind of gene therapies are available? So that was the kind of work that I was doing when I was at UCLA. But interestingly, at the same time, I would go to these Parkinson's disease meetings. So I thought, you know what? I don't want to just be the scientist in the lab. I actually want to connect with the community and see what their issues were. And I really started to hone in on the quality of life issues. And for somebody who has Parkinson's, it's a quality of life issue. You know, by the time you have that disease, you've manifested the symptoms of the disease. You've lost 80% of the neurons in your brain that are responsible for controlling voluntary movement. So from a preventative standpoint, you think, okay, how do we get ahead of this? Like, first of all, if people have it, how do we help make them have the best quality of life possible? And number two, what do we do? You know, you've got these chronic degenerative diseases. I mean, you've got Alzheimer's disease right now. You know, 5 million people in the United States have it. It's expected to triple by 2050. We have zero drugs that actually stop Alzheimer's disease. Zero. And, you know, I'm going to pivot off Parkinson's and go to Alzheimer's for a minute. So Alzheimer's is 90% preventable by diet, through diet and lifestyle. And it's part of one of the reasons why I'm such an advocate for brain health and taking care of your brain health now versus waiting until you have a symptom, because a disease like Alzheimer's manifests 20 to 30 years at the cellular level before you have a symptom.
Okay. So let me ask you this then. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about Alzheimer's and you're talking about preventative health, right? So
yes.
What are some of the things when you're talking about a diet? Like what's the magic recipe that if you could feed somebody mm-hmm. today before they actually have this, you know, mm-hmm. what would that be?
Oh, there's so much you can do. So there was a study that was done by Rush University in 2015, where they looked at approximately a thousand people. That's actually part of their Rush Marine Aging Clinic. And they followed the dietary and lifestyle habits of these people. I think it was over the course of a decade. And what they found is they actually created what's called the MIND diet, which is a modified Mediterranean diet plus the DASH diet, which is a low sodium diet, people who followed that had a 50% less chance of getting Alzheimer's disease. So if I'm just going to take a broad brushstroke over this, because there's so many details that I can get into. And as a neuroscientist, I love the minutiae. I mean, I can get into the fine details, but I think for people now following a Mediterranean based diet.
So give me some examples of,
I'm going to give you some examples. So I'm going to do a Mediterranean diet that is whole food plant-based. So for example, on a day-to-day basis, you want to be getting 2 servings of fresh fruits. So fruits and vegetables are at the core of brain health.
Yeah.
First of all, most Americans aren't eating 2 servings of fruits and 3 servings of greens per day. And that, if anybody's going to make one change today that they can take with them for the rest of their lives, that is probably the number one change, because they're loaded with antioxidants and they're anti-inflammatory. Neurons in your brain die because of oxidation. So by eating 2 servings of fresh fruits and 3 servings of fresh vegetables, and you want to rotate them out so you get a variety of micro and macronutrients.
Well, I'll tell you, everything you just said is in my 7-Summit smoothie. So I'm very excited.
I need to hear about your smoothie.
Well, it's secret. I might tell you, but I'm on the road to success, which is nice to hear. Okay.
So, I like that.
Yeah. So keep going.
Okay. So we want to do that. We want the proteins that you have. So if you do 3 servings of proteins a day, you want to keep the serving size small, right? So the size of the palm of your hand, like 5 ounces of, you know, if you're going to do animal fat. So, you know, I know people don't want to give up their beef and their chicken. So you want everything to be grass-fed, organic, you know, free range. But the one caveat that I want to make about animal proteins, you want to be very careful with saturated fat. It's inflammatory in the body, and the whole all degenerative diseases, as well as cancers and diabetes, are inflammatory.
Yep.
So part of the way we're quelling the inflammation is through the vegetables, which are anti-inflammatory. So when you're thinking about your proteins, if you're not going to do a whole food plant-based and you do want a little bit of meat, just keep the serving size small and have it the cleanest, you know, sources. And the other thing that I need to say about meat is that 80% of the antibiotics that we have in the United States go towards livestock. So livestock are consuming these antibiotics. We're eating the meat that has the antibiotics. That's impacting our gut health. That's a whole nother topic, right? Going into the microbiome.
The gut is directly affected upon your brain, right?
The gut produces 90% of your brain serotonin, which is the feel-good neurotransmitter. It produces 50% of the dopamine, which, you know, dopamine everybody loves, because that's the hit that you get when you have coffee. So you've got your serotonin, your dopamine, your B vitamins. So the key to optimal health, we actually want to have a diversity of organisms, microorganisms within your gut. And the best way to do that is whole food plant-based. You want to keep the meats down. You want to be careful of your grains. So on a Mediterranean diet, I would let the people that I worked with have 1 serving of grains a day. So again, you've got to think about most crops today. When you're thinking about grains, most crops have desiccant put on them that have the Roundup, so the weed killer Roundup on it. And again, a lot of that we're taking into our body, Roundup is killing the good bacteria that are in our gut, and it's causing leaky gut. So leaky gut syndrome, unfortunately, leaky gut is when you start to create holes in the intestinal membrane. So you get bigger chunks of food that get into the bloodstream. You know, then you have this inflammatory response. So people think they have gluten insensitivities, which they do. That's part of what causes it. But a lot of times this leaky gut is also going to lead to a leaky brain. It disrupts the blood-brain barrier, and that's when we start having inflammation in the brain. So when we think about grains, you want to have 1 serving a day, and think about whole grains, you know, amaranth, millet, quinoa, wild rice. So you're allowed one serving of that, one serving of beans or legumes. So beans, legumes, chickpeas are incredible. I think that's a great source of protein. And a lot of vegans, you know, are getting their protein pretty much from, you know, lentils and vegetables. So you want to have that. Let's see. So we've got protein, two servings of fruits, three servings of vegetables. And with the vegetables, by the way, I want to add the caveat, you want to try to get the orange vegetables in each day as well. So
the bottom line here is that eating really is tough, right? And because
eating well is easy.
Well, no, I get that. But I think when you go, I mean, it's not all, I'm not making excuses because I eat a lot of the things that you're talking about, but what I think that a lot of people in general, when they go to the store and they're hungry because they're rushing to go from point A to point B and they just have a minute. And so they turn around, they grab, you know, whatever's convenient. And you can sometimes get into this trap. And I think it takes real discipline, just like everything else you do in life, to really execute, to make sure that you're feeding your body with the right stuff. So what I want to do is I want to pivot just a little bit. And because this is fascinating to me, and that is your work with the NFL, right? So, yes. And I'm not sure if the connection is exactly with the NFL or with NFL players. I know they're kind of one, they're kind of attached, but they're not, right? So my understanding is that you have worked with one of the first players that had CTE. I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but why don't you just give me some background on how, what your connection is with the NFL or NFL players?
Okay, yes. So in 2009, I took a job with the Amon Clinics as their director of nutrition and nutraceuticals, which then turned into their director of research. Amon Clinics being an outpatient psychiatric clinic that uses brain imaging to help in the targeted treatment of psychiatric disorders. And so I started that back in May of 2009. And I want to say a week into starting my job, we ended up doing what would become at the time one of the world's largest brain imaging studies in living professional football players. And what we did was we looked at 100 NFL players' brains, and we were essentially asking the question, what are the effects of playing football on long-term brain function? And just a simple study using a few forms of neuroimaging, we looked at electrical imaging of brain, functional imaging, we did neuropsychiatric assessments, we did two types of cognitive assessments, one testing for dementia, and one just a basic cognitive impairment tests. And that study, I would say, has been life-changing for me in many ways. Number one, as you know, a former athlete, I really connected with the players in our study. And I'll tell you, the first 15 players that we worked with, when we started to see some of the damage that had happened in their brain, we knew as a clinic that worked on treating patients, we couldn't just do a study and say, here's what your brain looks like. You know, there's some areas that are damaged. There's some areas with low blood flow. There's some areas where the neural connectivity is weak. Goodbye. You know, have a nice day. That just, you know, and sometimes that just happens in research studies, right? You're doing a research study, you give somebody their results, and then they leave. Well, ours was unique in that we realized we really wanted to help these guys improve their brain function. What ended up happening is we started doing a second trial, which we called an open label trial. And anybody who worked with us who wanted to continue working with us, we led a program of diet and lifestyle interventions only. Since we were paying for everything, we decided, okay, I'm going to run brain-directed weight loss group for the players. I'm actually going to teach them how to take care of themselves. You know, every 2 weeks, I'd have the guys come on and I'd teach them about how to take care of their brains. And we put them on a nutrient protocol, so a sort of a suite of supplements that entailed multivitamin, brain-directed multivitamin, high levels of omega-3 fatty acids, and a brain formula that essentially contained things to boost acetylcholine, which would help with memory, boost antioxidant levels to protect neurons in the brain, and help to improve blood flow. And again, I won't get into the minutia because all of these topics I can go down, you know, these rabbit holes, and I'll be talking to you for 5 hours. But long story short, we saw that the dietary and lifestyle and nutrient interventions alone helped 25 out of the first 30 players. So we saw 80% improvement in sleep, mood, general cognitive function. And this was after 6 months. So 6 months, we had them come back. We had them retake all of their tests. But I think what was more eye-opening for me at the time was we had imaged their brain, and it had shown generally football players, unfortunately, just because of the number of concussive and subconcussive hits that are taken over the course of a career. You know, the players who are in our study had to have played in the NFL a minimum of 3 years, which means, you know, their lifetime football exposure was a minimum of a decade, right? If you think 4 years high school, 4 years college, 3 years football. So long story short, within a 6 month time frame on just nutrient and dietary interventions, we saw extraordinary changes in blood flow to the brain. So where their initial scans, we saw low blood flow. We say it's sort of diffuse hypoperfusion, meaning low blood flow throughout the brain, frontal lobes, temporal lobes, parietal lobes, occipital lobes, and cerebellum. I mean, it was pretty significant when you compare it to a healthy normative database. And after 6 months of doing the program, there were improvements in blood flow throughout the brain. And I won't get into the details, but it was eye-opening for me because number one, I think I told you here, I came from a laboratory setting and I wanted to work in a clinical setting with patients. So now I'm here working with these football players and noticing that we can actually restore some of the brain function that had been lost just through, you know, it's through aging and through a combination of having participated in a collision-based sport. And it was eye-opening and revelatory to me because I will admit to you, at that point in time, you know, I was open to looking at the effects of nutraceuticals on brain function. I'd started thinking about it back when I was at UCLA and with Parkinson's patients, because people who have Parkinson's, you want to do everything you can to support your central nervous system, right? And my motto is no brain left behind. So I don't care what disease you have. I don't care if you have, you know, ALS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, mild cognitive impairment, we can work on your brain. And there's things we can do. You know, we may not be able to reverse your disease, but we might be able to slow it down. We might be able to stop its progression. Might be able to have you better, help you to have a better quality of life. And this work with the football players was the first tangible evidence I had seen that something as simple as dietary and nutrient interventions could change brain function electrically and perfusion-wise. And trust me, when we help bring more blood flow back to your brain, that brings more oxygen to the cells, that saves brain tissue that could be destroyed. And trust me, we had other things that we did with the players too. We had hyperbaric oxygen therapy, transcranial magnetic stimulation, neurofeedback. So we have a toolbox of things that we could use, but just these simple strategies. And, you know, what turned out, you know, we worked with 100 players and for that particular study, ended up having had a waiting list of over 200. I want to say I had like 250 players. So I knew there was an interest in this work. And, you know, I've spent the last 10 years helping players take care of their brain health.
That's incredible. You know, we go back to what my question was earlier on in the pod about what that gap is and really, you know, how do you make that leap? And it must be like, you know, scoring the last minute touchdown, you know, the Super Bowl or something when you have this research that comes back and there's a positive effect because of the things that you're doing. It must be incredible. Last year, the year before, I was invited to come down to a hospital, Hoag Hospital in LA. It was one of the approved NFL facilities to go down and get a full scan from top to bottom. I mean, it literally was 2 days. Most physicals take, you know, an hour. And this one was two days, you know, starting at 8 a.m., finishing at 5 on each one of those. And the last one was to put me in one of those scanner machines, and I was, you know, on my face, I looked like Hannibal Lecter and they stuffed me in there and I was freaking out, man. And I said, pull me out of here. And the music was going and the knock, 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 knock. And I just couldn't handle it. And I pulled out of there and they go, you sure you don't want to finish this? And I was just like, you know what? I'm doing everything possible, from working out twice a day to working my brain in terms of what I do professionally with Sports Illustrated, in my Seven Summit smoothie, my diet, where if I'm not getting better because I feel fine, then it is what it is. But it's just, it was interesting just trying to get that data. I was all game for it, but it just freaked me out, just stuffed me in that thing.
There's a lot to it. I actually have so much respect for the players who had the courage to come in and get their brain scanned. I actually think that's really courageous. And what I love about working with players is that you guys are so motivated and dedicated. So whatever things that we recommended that the players do, they listened. And I think what's been the most inspiring is that you can make simple changes, simple lifestyle changes, and it can have a tremendous impact on blood flow to the brain and the way the neurons are connecting in your brain. So I think, you know, one of the more encouraging notes is that people don't have to think that there isn't anything they could do, right? There's always something you can do to make it better. And diet plays a huge role. Sleep plays a huge role. You know, I could go on about sleep and great sleep hygiene practices, but there's so many, you know, we have so many tools at our disposal just within our own homes to help improve our brain function.
Well, that's encouraging, right? I mean, it's encouraging when you have, we all hang on this little thing called hope. And right now, you and I are talking, it's the 28th of April. We're in the middle of the coronavirus. And there's a lot of people that are losing or have lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, it's just a tough time for a lot of people. And I think what we all hang on at the end of the day is this little thing called hope, and hope, you know, with the possibility that whatever bad position that we're in today, that it's going to get better in the future.
You know what? I think there's always something to be hopeful for. There's always, you know, every day that I wake up, I think it's a new day. It's a magical day. There's, you know, somebody new I could meet, something new I could learn, a life that I could touch, inspire in some way. And I'll tell you, I think it's probably important to share with you on this podcast, is that the irony wasn't lost on me that here I went to graduate school studying Parkinson's disease. I then start to work with professional athletes, some of whom, you know, as you had mentioned, you know, end up having Parkinson's, ALS, and dementia, and some of those players, you know, I'm currently working with. But my father ended up having Parkinson's as well. So he had an essential tremor for several years that later turned into more of a Parkinsonian syndrome. And he ended up passing away in 2017 from something unrelated to Parkinson's. But I find that sometimes life has really interesting threads and interesting roads that we have to walk down. And since the passing of my father, and my mom has passed as well, I've now really wanted to dedicate my life to helping people who are struggling with brain issues, concussions, neurological issues, and helping to inspire people to live more brain healthy lives now more than ever.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. I mean, look, it's all about, I think, it's about giving back, right? And I've brought this up before, but I just love it. This song, Humble and Kind, by Tim McGraw. And it's about, you know, one of the verses is about when you get to where you're going, don't forget to turn around and help the next person in line, and always remember to be humble and kind. And I think, you know, you've been very humble about your accomplishments in the short time I've gotten to know you, and you're trying to help people out there in general. And when you're one of those people afflicted with Parkinson's, buddies who I know who have that, I've got buddies who have ALS, I've got plenty of football guys who've got CTE, you know, from playing way too many years of violent football. I may or may not have it, I don't know. But the bottom line is when you can turn around and dedicate your life towards helping those people, that's the magical moment, not only for you, because you get the satisfaction over, you know, taking your craft, and you were born with a lot of gifts. And one of those gifts is the power of knowledge and doing well in school, and now taking that gift forward that you can help others that are just trying to figure it out. And that's quite a blessing. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's so kind of you to say. I really appreciate it. So lovely to be able to talk to you. And you have such an inquisitive mind. You've asked amazing questions. And, you know, I think one thing that I wanted to end with is, you know, being in this field, working with athletes, I think it's really interesting that I spent 10 years showing horses, having fallen off, having hit my head many, many times. And now I find myself at this time in life working with athletes who play these collision-based sports and who are struggling. And, you know, I'm one of these people that has a firm appreciation of sports and athletics and the great things that we get from participating in them. And I think at this point, you know, we can all just learn that it's important to take care of our brains. We can't change our pasts, right? And what we've done, and we can only just move forward and do the best we can now.
Absolutely agree. There's no regrets. And the one thing that I think it's hard for everybody, I'll leave it at this, is that a lot of times when certain things happen to us, you know, we ask the question, why and how did this happen? And you go down that path. And what I've learned is that all these things have been put purposely in my life, whether it's been a struggle or a victory, for life's lessons, which sometimes and many times aren't revealing themselves, you know, on face value at the moment. But as I look back on them 10 years, I couldn't be doing this podcast today if I hadn't gone through the struggles I've gone through and seen the peaks and the valleys. That's has been part of my journey, and that's made me better armed and prepared to interview brilliant people like you on these different types of podcasts to inspire others to keep going, that, you know, there's hope, that you got to go through, you can't go around it. You can't jump over it. Like on your horse, you literally have to go through it and experience it and then pop out a better person. But you got to keep moving, and you got to keep moving with gusto and a positive spirit. So where can people find you? I know you have a book coming out. I want to plug that really quickly as we kind of wrap up. Yeah. So tell me about your book.
The book is called Biohack Your Brain, How to Boost Cognitive Health, Performance, and Power. And it's being published by HarperCollins, William Mora Books. It will be out December 29th, 2020. And I basically give people the simple steps that they can do to take care of their brain health now. And a lot of it is the work that I did with professional football players, and I give client stories and I talk about my own story. So I make it really fun. It's loaded with great neuroscience facts, but fun ones. So very easily digestible. And you know, I'm really proud, and I hope it helps a lot of people. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share that. And then if anybody wants to find me, I have a website at drwillemeyer.com, and you can find me on Instagram at @kwillemeyer and Facebook and Twitter at Dr. Willemeyer.
There she is. She's all over the place. She's all over the universe. So thank you for that. Listen, so appreciate, so grateful that you came on the pod. You shared all your experience, and you continue to do things to help others, you know, going out into the future. So to everybody who's listening, who's thinking about brain health and health overall, she's the person, she's the go-to Wonder Woman that has many of the answers, or at least can head you in the right direction. So again, thank you for coming on.
Mark, thank you for your beautiful spirit, your kind heart. You know, I'm here if you ever need guidance with your daughter. And thank you again. It's really been such a pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
As a quarterback, I love sports, but sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips Haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo, which is better than sports plus Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.